Hey guys, let me tell you about the sponsor for today's episode. Podcorn is a marketplace connecting podcasters to amazing podcast opportunities, such as the one I'm doing right now. They have host read ads, interview segments, and more. The great thing about Podcorn is there is no middleman. Podcasters of all sizes can browse and pick opportunities right on the platform. You set your own rates and you collaborate with brands directly. The best thing is that you never give up any rights to your podcast, and Podcorn will support you every step of the way to ensure that you are protected and compensated for the work you do. Click the link on my show notes page to sign up to Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today. The American History Podcast, Season 4, Episode 21, Spring 1942. Listeners, friends, and Patreons, I'm happy to have you back for another episode of World War II in the Pacific. I know, it's been a while, but we are back to the main narrative. Now, just a bit of housekeeping before we get into the story. I'm back to teaching AP and dual credit U.S. history, so the release schedule for the next few months might be a tad sporadic. While I do have an MA and all of the coursework for the PhD specializing in U.S. history, the reality is I've not taught this course in about 6 years or so, and thus, I might have some months where I only release one episode during that time. Now, hopefully it won't happen, but I thought I'd give you a heads up just in case it does. Now, if you're enjoying the show, check out the website at www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com. You can see all sorts of stuff there, including a link to sign up for the Patreon. There's a ton of extra stuff on Patreon that's only available on Patreon, including two different bonus series. The first is 1983, the year the world almost ended, which is what you get for the $5 a month donation. Now, if you sign up for the $10 a month level, you get access to that series plus Quagmire, which is a history of American involvement in the Middle East. And all levels, of course, get the regular show ahead of time and commercial free. So please go check it out. All right, so enough of that. Last time we left off with Japan steamrolling her way through the South Pacific area, taking the Philippines, Malaya, and Singapore. Now, things were looking fairly bleak for the Allies, and one could be forgiven for thinking that the Japanese looked unstoppable. Of course, they were far from it, but no one knew it at the time. Today, we are going to be talking about several things as we get ready to delve into the Battle of the Coral Sea. However, before we get there, we have to talk about a few things, so let's go ahead and do that. Of course, we can't do any of that until we have our Song of the Week, which this week is the March of the Battleship Gunken Machi. I hope I said that right. I probably messed it up. But enjoy the song, and we'll see you in a few minutes.
Oh,
It's April 1942. The Japanese people, along with their leadership, was elated. The Southern Offensive was a smashing success. One metaphor had... Let me start that again, Chris. God damn it. April 1942. The Japanese people, along with leadership, were elated. The Southern Offensive was a smashing success. Now, one metaphor was that it was running like a railroad, and in this case, the trains were arriving ahead of schedule. As historian Ian Toll notes, in just 4 months, the Japanese had created one of the greatest empires in world history. Their imperial territory now stretched from the Kurile Islands in the north to Timor in the south, from the Gilberts in the east all the way to the borders of India. Having said that, there were still pockets of resistance, especially in and around the Philippines, but that resistance would not last much longer. In the months since December 7th, Japan, an island that was famously resource poor, had captured vast oil, rubber, tin, and bauxite resources, all of which were needed to run a modern economy. Even more impressive, this empire had been won with little cost, at least for the Japanese. 10,000 men were the total number of casualties, with merchant shipping having lost about 25,000 tons. The Imperial Japanese Navy had been virtually untouched, having lost nothing more than a destroyer. Needless to say, these were the golden days of the Japanese Empire. 3 days after Singapore fell, the emperor appeared in front of a rapturous throng just outside the walls of the Imperial Palace. Dressed in full military regalia and mounted on a white horse, he rode out across one of the bridges and sat impressively as the people shouted, "Banzai!" A few days later, Hideki Tojo, the Prime Minister and Minister of War, declared that Singapore had been renamed Shonan Island. It was party time in Japan. One example of the festivities is the port city of Kure, where all of the restaurants and the tea houses were reserved for parties to celebrate the victories. According to Ian Toll, the geishas were working overtime, and when the geishas weren't available, the enlisted men performed their own singing and dancing routines, aided by a large amount of alcohol. Quote, "I don't know how much sake I consumed in the process. Nothing but my rugged physique pulled me through the chain drinking that lasted until the banquet ended around midnight," end quote, according to one Japanese officer. Now, if you're wondering, the Japanese people now embraced the war. Everyone loves a winner, let's face it. And they were, without a doubt, winning. The propaganda that Japan was a great nation whose destiny was to rule over Asia appeared to be true. The military government was now able to dispense with most of the trappings of democracy, although elections were not done away with. Instead, political parties were dissolved, and one party created the Imperial Rule Assistance Association. Their job was to approve any candidate for office. So-called neighborhood associations were created to keep people in line. Their job was to distribute rations, pro-war slogans, organize air raids, stand fire watches, and even report anything suspicious. Now, when soldiers or sailors were sent off to war, they were paraded about, wearing white sashes with the red sun, and then they went to a Shinto shrine where they were ritually purified. The Japanese, it was later said, had fallen victim to shoribyo, or victory disease. The symptoms of this disease were overconfidence and a basic misunderstanding of their enemy. It was fed by a constant stream of propaganda from state-controlled media. But it all made sense in the moment. The people saw the footage and photos of American ships burning at Pearl Harbor. They saw the retreat of the British and the defeat of the Royal Navy. The West had been tested in the Pacific, and it had failed. What could explain this weakness? Apparently, the enemy was weak, and they were dismissed as cowards who were interested in only saving their own lives. But while this fever penetrated down to the average person, what about the leadership? They were drunk with victory fever as well. A great example was Admiral Yamamoto. He transferred his flag from the battleship Nagato to the newly commissioned Yamato, a super battleship. She was the largest such ship ever built. Coming in at over 800 feet in length, fully loaded, she displaced over 70,000 tons and was armed with 9 18-inch guns, the most powerful such weapons ever created for a battleship. It was a massive ship, and the Admiral had quarters that were unlike any other in the Imperial Navy. Perhaps unlike any other in the world at that point, to be honest. His cabins were air-conditioned, and his meals he took in a fancy wardroom with a long, polished table. Here, the Admiral entertained visitors, including members of the royal family. Admiral Yamamoto was being acclaimed by both the Japanese media and the public. However, to his credit, he did not get drunk on the adulation. In fact, he was embarrassed by it. He thought the euphoria of the moment was, at best, short-sighted. He warned that the Japanese had yet to encounter the Americans at their best. Where before the Japanese Navy was nicknamed the Silent Navy, now it was called Invincible, even by the members of the Navy itself. Yamamoto remarked, quote, "What happened to the Navy's modesty, a trait that had so starkly distinguished it from the Army in the past?" End quote. Yamamoto was, in a way, prophetic. Before the war, he had predicted just this, quote, "For a while, we'll have everything our own way, stretching out in every direction like an octopus spreading its tentacles. But it'll last for a year and a half at most," end quote. He believed the best they could hope for was that the war would end in an armistice. Negotiation and concessions would have to be made. He thought that when Singapore finally fell, perhaps 6 months into the war, the British would be willing to negotiate. That was due to the threat the Japanese posed to India. The Americans might be harder to placate, but he believed they could be placated. His idea was to fight, conquer, bargain, and concede. Yamamoto, unlike the rest of the Imperial Navy commanders, was the last to serve in the Russo-Japanese War. And in that war, the Japanese had bargained from a position of strength by destroying the Russian Navy. However, after the war, the Japanese were dissatisfied with the treaty they had signed. Now, in 1942, when they were even more ruthless than they had ever been, having been taught that they were a celestial race sent to push the Western invaders out of Asia, yeah, good luck with that. Now, nothing short of total victory would do. However, what if the alternative was total defeat? By April 1942, the Japanese were the most powerful military and naval power in the Pacific. But how could they hope to maintain that status? The reality was the titanic industrial capacity of the United States and its ability to wage war had not been destroyed or even attacked. It was simply a matter of time before they could launch massive attacks against the perimeters of the Japanese Empire. A war of attrition meant a Japanese loss for sure. Thus, the Japanese had to essentially run out the clock. They had to find a way to inflict enough punishment on the Allies that the Allies would be willing to negotiate. Now, the issue, of course, was how do you do that? How do you run out the clock? The Army believed they should continue to move in the South Pacific. Here, they could fortify their positions and even take Port Moresby on New Guinea. That operation was already in motion anyway, so you might as well continue in that direction. Plus, this would allow them to harass shipping in the Coral Sea. However, in mid-March, none other than Yamamoto himself threw a wrench into these plans. He argued it was best if the Japanese military instead moved in the Central Pacific and should instead hit Midway. This would allow the Japanese to then invade Hawaii, which had long been a dream of Japanese imperialists. However, Yamamoto's true goal was not an invasion of Hawaii. Instead, he wanted to draw the American aircraft carriers out and destroy them in one major battle. The American Navy had used its flat tops to hit the Japanese in raids back in February, and while none had done any real damage, they had shown that, despite the euphoria, the Americans were very much still in the war and still capable of hitting back. To bring this point home, Admiral Halsey had led a raid on Little Marcus Island, just 600 miles from the home islands. By March, a draft of the Midway operation was drawn up, and by early April, a conference at the Imperial General Headquarters settled the issue. But it took Yamamoto's not-so-veiled threat to resign if he did not get his way to decide the issue. Thus, on April 5th, the issue was finally decided in favor of Yamamoto and his plan to attack Midway. The only point not yet decided was exactly when the attack on Midway would take place. In the meantime, across the Pacific at Alameda Naval Air Station, 16 B-25s were being loaded using a massive crane onto the Hornet, a new Yorktown-class aircraft carrier. The next day, April the 2nd, the Hornet got underway, along with her escorts, two heavy cruisers, four destroyers, and a fuel tanker. This group was given the designation Task Force 18. As the morning fog lifted, the ships passed under the Golden Gate Bridge, and anyone watching could see an unusual sight. first aircraft carriers were a rare sight. But one loaded with Army bombers? Even more so. As far as the crew was concerned, there were rumors about their mission, but nothing had yet been confirmed. They thought they were simply taking the planes to Hawaii. Nothing could be further from the truth. As early as just a few hours after Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt had asked his military leaders to find a way to hit back at Japan. Then, over the next 3 months, he continued to press the issue. Again and again, he asked if there was any way to hit the Japanese home islands. Admiral Ernest King assigned two staff officers to the task. There were no easy answers. First, Japan was far away, and there were no territorial airfields nearby which could be used. China, the Soviet Union, even the Aleutian Islands were considered and then discarded. Perhaps a carrier task force could get close enough to launch a raid, but they'd have to get within 200 miles. That meant the carriers, while waiting for her aircraft to return, would be vulnerable. And in early 1942, the last thing the U.S. Navy needed was to lose one of its flat tops. So what to do? The captain of the newly commissioned Hornet had an idea. How about using Army bombers? They could never land on a carrier, but could they take off? When planes launch off a ship, the ship turns into the wind to help generate the necessary lift. Further, the carrier speeds up. In the Central Pacific, it's easy to create a headwind of 40 knots. But could they possibly take off? Then, after the raid, what would they do? Well, the bombers could land in China. This would all be extremely risky for the carriers, and perhaps deadly for the crews of these airplanes. However, best of all, it would be unexpected by the Japanese. All they needed was a bit of luck and surprise. Admiral King took the concept to Hap Arnold, the chief of the Army Air Corps, who was willing to give it a shot. General Arnold chose Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle, one of the most famous pilots in the country, to lead the mission. He identified the best plane for the job as the B-25. Planning for the mission went forward under a veil of secrecy. They figured that the B-25 could be stripped of all non-critical equipment, including the gun turret, the bomb sight, and even the radio. Further, they would only carry a one-ton bomb, giving the aircraft an effective range of 2,400 nautical miles. Doolittle recruited a volunteer group of pilots and crew members, and then all of them had to undergo flight training in the techniques needed to take off from a carrier at sea. Prior to launch, the pilot needs to throttle the engine to full power and then release the brakes, and the plane can shoot down the flight deck. Amazingly, with a decent headwind, the planes would be able to take off going just about 65 to 70 miles an hour. On April 13th, Hornet was on top of the international dateline, approximately 1,700 miles out of Hawaii. As dawn broke, the sailors were greeted with a rolling sea checkered with whitecaps. As the light improved, they noticed a second aircraft carrier off the port beam. They'd been joined in the night by Enterprise. She came with screening vessels, the cruisers Northampton and Salt Lake City, along with four destroyers and a fueling tanker. This was Task Force 16, commanded by Admiral Halsey. The two forces were joined into one, with Halsey in command. The job of Enterprise was to provide protection and reconnaissance, as the Hornet had to keep her own air wing down below in the hangar. Now, the sailors on the Enterprise were left to wonder where they were headed and what was the mission. Perhaps they were headed to a base in Russia. It was obvious the Hornet carried Army bombers. The question was, where were they going? They didn't have to wait long. Before lunchtime, Halsey authorized a public announcement, one that electrified the crew. Their destination was Tokyo. The fleet now headed almost directly west, speed 16 knots. For several days, they headed west, traversing almost the exact same course the Japanese fleet had used when they headed for Pearl Harbor. Now, in those parts of the Pacific, the weather is not, shall we say, forgiving. The sea and the sky were gray. The wind was cold and harsh. It was not, needless to say, smooth sailing. Then, about 1,000 miles outside of Tokyo, the weather turned for the worse. A gale force wind came up out of the southwest. Visibility dropped to less than a mile, and cold spray came up over the flight decks of the flat tops. Flight ops off Enterprise were canceled. The carriers and cruisers increased speed to 22 knots, leaving their other escort ships behind and closed to about 600 miles from Tokyo. Now, the plan was to launch on April 19th. However, on April 18th, the task force breached Admiral Yamamoto's picket line. At about 0310, the Enterprise picked up two blips on the radar screen, only 4 miles away. These were picket ships, but so far, she, Enterprise, had been unseen. They turned northwest to avoid the ships, and then, after about an hour, headed back west. At about 0400, Enterprise launched a search flight and combat air patrol. It was 0715 when one of the search planes came back with a message. An enemy surface ship had been spotted about 42 miles away. The SPD believed the Japanese had spotted them as well. The game was up. However, Halsey wanted to get Doolittle as close as he could. The task force continued west. It was 7:44 when the lookouts on board the Enterprise spotted a small vessel about 2 miles away. This ship was the Nitamaru, a 90-foot-long fishing sampan. Funny story, but a crewman told the captain of the ship there were two beautiful Japanese aircraft carriers passing by. The skipper, viewing the ships on the horizon, noted, yes, they were beautiful, but they weren't Japanese. He radioed in immediately, and his message was heard by the Americans. The cover was certainly blown by now. Enterprise messaged Hornet, quote, launch planes. To Colonel Doolittle and his gallant command, good luck and God bless you. Halsey. End quote. Hornet turned into the wind and prepared to launch. In the meantime, Nashville raced towards the Japanese fishing vessel and opened fire with her 6-inch battery. The little Japanese fishing boat had shells landing all around her, but not even one hit. Finally, a group of fighters off Enterprise scored a hit, and the little boat sank. In the meantime, on the Hornet, the B-25s launched. First was Doolittle's plane. There was some doubt as to whether or not any of them actually could do it. They were successful, and all 15 made it into the air. The sailors on board shouted in glee, all impressed by the courage of the men on board those airplanes. Hundreds of miles away, in Japan, the report sent out by Nitomaru was received on board the Yamato. The report said three American carriers had been spotted just over 700 miles away. That was the first mistake it contained. Three American carriers? The Japanese believed the U.S. Navy only had three carriers in all of the Pacific. If all three were charging toward Japan, then they had a chance to destroy the flat tops once and for all, and truly cripple the Americans' ability to wage war in the Pacific for the foreseeable future. Now, the second mistake in the report was something it failed to mention. What was that? The fact that the second ship was carrying twin-engine bombers. Had they noted that, then the Japanese would have been able to figure out that this wasn't a naval strike, but an air raid. Instead, they were operating under the assumption that the former was true. Thus, the message went out, quote, enemy task force containing three aircraft carriers as main strength sighted 0630 this morning, 730 miles east of Tokyo. Operate against American fleet, end quote. Admiral Nagumo and his task force, heading home after operating in the Indian Ocean and off the coast of Formosa, at that point at least, was ordered to head to the waters east of Japan at full speed. Now, there were two other chances for the Japanese to figure out exactly what was happening. First, a report at 0945 came in from the east coast of Japan. A plane flying patrol reported spotting a strange-looking twin-engine bomber. This report was not taken seriously. Everyone knew that such airplanes could not be launched from a carrier. A second report came in from a picket vessel. This report noted several B-25s were coming in, quote, three enemy planes, course southwest, end quote. Again, the report was dismissed as nonsensical. It had to be an error. Now, of course, we know they were right. Right around noon in Tokyo, on April 18, the first bombers arrived. They came in at low altitude and, in a strange reenactment of Pearl Harbor, Japanese observers on the ground, assuming they had to be friendly, waved at them. The bombers passed over several military aircraft, which made no attempt to engage. The first wave came in and hit several targets, including an oil tank and a steel mill. They could have hit the Imperial Palace itself, but were under strict orders from Doolittle to do no such thing. The next wave came in, and they also successfully dropped their bombs. Then all headed out toward China. When Admiral Yamamoto was informed that Tokyo had been bombed from the air, he became physically ill. Retreating to his stateroom, he closed the door and did not emerge for several hours. While the admiral was in isolation, Admiral Ugaki took over command of the fleet. The Japanese did everything they could to try and find the bombers and the carriers. They were unable to find the American Navy, which, after launching their planes, turned and raced away at full speed, headed east. Believe it or not, the Americans were able to tune in and listen to Japanese naval transmissions as well as Radio Tokyo. The Navy, obviously flustered and in chaos after the bombing raid, were broadcasting in plain language. The messages were confused and confirmed the Japanese were shocked, unable to figure out how the Americans had done it. From Radio Tokyo, they learned the bombers had reached their targets. This was because right around 2 p.m. local, or noontime Tokyo, the English language broadcaster suddenly went off script. There was some mumbling in Japanese, then silence. After half an hour of dead silence, the announcer came back on, speaking in Japanese. The Americans listening may not have understood what he was saying, but they could hear air raid sirens in the background, and that told them all they needed to know. What the announcer was saying is that atrocities had been committed, schools and hospitals had been hit, blood was needed, the country was in danger. Then, after a few hours of this sort of reporting, it appears they were given new scripts. Now the listener was told the military and defense officials had everything in hand. Apparently, the enemy had been chased away and shot down. The reality is that Doolittle and his planes had escaped. They did scatter widely over the East China Sea, but most of them made it safely to China, with one landing in the Soviet Union. Of the 80 crew members, 69 survived and made it home. As for casualties, 3 were killed in action. God, let me start that again. Jesus, what's wrong with me today? Of the 80 crew members, 69 survived and made it home. As for the casualties, 3 were killed in action, 2 of them off the coast of China. 8 were taken as POWs, 3 of them were executed, and 1 died in captivity. In the end, the raid did little physical damage. However, it certainly boosted American morale while damaging that of the Japanese. The Japanese Navy especially bore responsibility for allowing the Americans to attack the Japanese homeland. Further, what little resistance remained to Yamamoto's idea of to attack Midway crumbled. He insisted Midway must have been the base for the attack, but of course he was wrong. On April 20, at a meeting of Army and Navy planners, it was agreed that Midway would, indeed, be the next major push in the war. The offensive was set to take place the first week of June. Okay, so that's where we leave off for today. Now, next time, we will begin our discussion of the Battle of the Coral Sea. Until then, I'm your humble host, and you've been listening to episode 4.21, Spring 1942, and I'll see you all again soon.
Wandering, who is
shut it off or I'll rip.
Oh, Pete, where do I get?
Wait a minute. Your fault.